Well, just to recap, last week we, or last lesson, we talked about, do you love me? And this was the lesson title, Jesus' foremost commandment is to love God with all our heart, soul, and mind. So we know the what to do, that is to love God. We know the how to do it, and that is with all our heart, soul, and mind. And then we also know the why, and that is because our Creator, our giver of life, our God, is worthy of our love. Not only does our love serve His best interest, but more importantly, for ourselves anyway, it serves our best interest. Anytime that we are serving God's will, it always benefits ourselves, every single time. We also examine Jesus' confrontation with Peter. Three times He asked him, "Do you love me?" You might remember that there in John 21, verse 15 through 17. Remember, Peter had also denied Jesus three times, and so Jesus had to reestablish that relationship and also be able to entrust to him a responsibility to be a leader. But first of all, he said, in essence, in order to lead my people, I need to know where you stand with me. So that's why he asked him those things. The questions were not just for Peter, of course, they were for us too. The question to us was, do you love him? Do you love him more than anyone else? You know, Christians are usually well aware that they need to give gifts to God. We talk about this sometimes, make a return on the talents, the resources, the gifts that God has given to you. That's a good thing. And yet, love is not usually considered a gift. It's not usually considered our gift to God. It's kind of one of those things that is so right up front and is so involved in so many things and yet assumed. It's taken for granted. It's not really appreciated for what it is. And if you think about Paul in writing 1 Corinthians 13, which we'll talk about in a minute, and that he had read for you at least the first seven verses, Paul is talking to the Corinthians about their spiritual gifts and their management of those gifts, and some are holding some gifts up higher than others. You know, someone says, "I speak in tongues." Well, I have prophecy. Well, I can heal, and so on. And Paul ends chapter 12, verse 31 with, "Let me show you a still more excellent way." And this is not unlike a church of any kind, our church included, where we might be focusing on, you know, different things that we can do, different services that we can provide, different talents that we can express, and so on. Nothing wrong with any of that in itself, but there's still a more excellent way than just that. And that's what Paul is saying to us as well. We tend to focus on deeds and services. We don't necessarily focus on our love. And so what Paul says in this still more excellent way in order to serve God is to love him with the finest love that you have. And this is something that anyone and everyone can do. There's no one exempt from this, regardless of circumstances or limitations. You might have limitations and you might have constrictive circumstances, but there's nothing stopping you, any of you, from loving God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your mind. Even if you are bedridden as a Christian, you could still love God in that way. So it's something that everyone not only can do, but Paul is imploring us, really God imploring us through Paul, to do just that. Spiritual gifts were temporary. They will cease and be done away with. He says that in chapter 13, verse 8, 1 Corinthians there. It's kind of like scaffolding. You know, when I've used this illustration before. You know, when you build big buildings, there's a bunch of big apartment complexes being built down in Kent, becoming a city unto itself, I think, down there by the golf course, right? And there's all these big scaffoldings up there as they're building the building. You know that as soon as the buildings are done, they're going to take the scaffolding down. Because the scaffolding is there for a limited, finite purpose. Miracles, miraculous gifts were there for the same reason. They were to provide support or confirmation that these messages coming from these people, and especially from the apostles, were indeed from God. Once that has been established, the building is built. The gospel has been shared. We don't need the gifts anymore. But the gift of love? Well, that's always needed. That doesn't go away. That's the one that we really want to focus on. Even faith and hope are limited and temporary. They're limited to this life. In heaven, we're not going to have faith and we're not going to need hope because what we have hoped in will be ours and what we put our faith in will be sitting there right in front of us. But love, that will always be there. And that's why Paul ends that chapter with the greatest of these is love, greater than faith, greater than hope. And love will always be there. Love is something permanent and unlimited and eternal in nature. We begin practicing it here as Christians, but it will continue into the eternity to come. Likewise, God shows us love here in our Christian walk, but he has so much more to show us in person. You have to believe that. That when he's right there in front of you and you are standing right there in front of him, you are going to experience God's love in a way that we never could have experienced it right here. And he's beckoning us toward that right now. That's what he wants for us. We have taken time to examine God's love and our need for a loving response. This lesson, we'll talk more about how to improve and grow our love. I don't want you to think that just because you have a love for God, that it's where it should be. Chances are, it can improve. And I don't mean that disrespectfully, like I'm doubting you or critiquing you. I'm just saying that's just how it is. Nobody has mastered this yet. But we can all do better. I'm certain of it. In 1 Corinthians chapter 13, verse 4 through 7 is probably the finest, most eloquent, the most powerful expression of godly love, agape love, that has ever been written. It is profound in its wording. It's profound in its summation, what it sums up. It is profound in its brevity, its briefness, if you will. It is not meant to be comprehensive, because it's stressing the beauty and the importance of God's love, not everything that could be said on it. In defining love, Paul actually defines God's essential nature. 1 John chapter 4, verse 8, John says there that God is love. And then Paul is sitting here saying, and this is what God, in his love, or being love, looks like. That's what he's saying here. He's not just saying that God is loving, although that's true too, or that God is a good teacher of how to love. He's that too. But that he is the very source, the very definition of what love is. And all Christian love is not just based on a passage, it's based on God himself. The passage just tells us about that God, but the love is based on the one who loves us. In John chapter 13, verse 34 and 35, Jesus says to his disciples, and we are his disciples, so he's saying it to us too, if you have love for one another, then this will prove to the world that you are my disciples, if you have love for one another. And then he says, and love one another as I have loved you. So he's providing the way of in which that love is to be expressed. He's modifying or qualifying that love with his own kind of love. He's not just saying, I want you to go out there and just love people to pieces however you choose to. It'll be good for God and everyone will be benefited by that. No, that's not necessarily true. There's a lot of people who don't know how to love well. But he says, if you love like I love you, then that will be to everyone's benefit, including your own. It's not a pick and choose thing. God is not asking for your selective version of his love or your personal preference of certain things about love, but then avoiding others. It is based on Jesus' love, which is the exact depiction of God's love. You know that Jesus is showing you in himself what God the Father does in our concept or understanding of his love. So back to Paul here in 1 Corinthians 13. What does he say about love? What does agape love really look like? What does God's love really look like? Well, I'm not going to go through all these in detail. That's what workbooks are for, right? But at least we want to say something, that love is patient. Love longs for someone to come to their senses and to reform, to do what is right. Love always is the noblest of causes. Because of that patience. It always seeks that person's best interest. It's not a knee-jerk reaction. It's not a rush to judgment. Love is kind, which means it's benevolent or gentle or affectionate, as opposed to, say, being sour or mean or spiteful or vindictive. I think we've all seen people that have loved us that showed us a very skewed version of love. probably relatives or parents or, people that claim they cared about us. You know, sometimes we don't get the right kind of love from people, but that's not what love is. Love is always kind, and love is not jealous. It doesn't show contempt for someone else's success or happiness or prosperity. It's not jealous of that. It doesn't say, oh, you got a job promotion better than what I have. That's nice, you know. It doesn't do that. Oh, you got a new car. I'm still driving my old 1997 jalopy. It doesn't do that either. I mean, love is happy for you. Love is expressing that happiness. You got a new car. I'm happy for you. You got a new job. I'm happy for you. You got a new child or grandchild. I'm happy for you. Love does that. God, when he sees our success, doesn't say, oh, you did that good, but you messed up in so many other areas. He says, I'm happy for you. I'm happy that you're doing well. Love does not brag, doesn't parade one's own accomplishments, but is humble, is modest, and always defers to someone else. Always seeks another person's best interests. Didn't Paul say that? Philippians 2, verse 3 and 4. We shouldn't be looking out just for our own interests, but put others' interests ahead of ourselves. That's what that means right there. Doesn't brag. And is not arrogant. It's not corrupted with human pride and conceit. You don't have to brag, by the way, to be arrogant. Bragging is something that people do. Arrogance is something that people are. So you don't have to necessarily brag in order to be arrogant in your heart. It is true, however, that arrogant people typically brag, okay? But that's not necessarily the case. You can be very arrogant in your heart and be very seemingly humble in your language. Love does not act unbecomingly, which means that it's never indecent or unseemly. It behaves itself, if you will. It behaves, it acts properly, it acts gracefully. It doesn't do something that it shouldn't do. It does not seek its own. It is unselfish. It doesn't pursue an agenda, any agenda, at someone else's expense. So if someone is loving you, but they're stepping on you to get to where they want to go, that's not love. At least that's not godly love. That's their version of love, perhaps. That is not godly love. Love is not provoked. It doesn't rush to judgment, as I said earlier. It's not sudden. It's not rash. It's not impetuous. Whenever I think of impetuous, I always think of Peter, because when I was young, that's what Peter was referred to. He's impetuous, and I had to look up the word impetuous. I didn't know what it meant. But it means what I'm saying right here, just someone who acts rashly or doesn't really think about what he's doing and just goes out and does it. And if you listen to Peter so many times when Jesus says something, and then Peter just reacts, right? He doesn't really think about it. Hey, we'll build three tents here, right? Even though everyone else dies for or falls away, rather, I will die for you. That's impetuous. Love is not like that. Love is not aggravated by someone else's evil or abuse. It's not baited or goaded by someone else's taunting or their challenge to love like they would love. In other words, to love wrongly. Love does not take into account a wrong suffered. Anyone who is married should be listening up right now. Because this is what married people do. Is they take into account a wrong suffered. Even though they claim to love their spouse, they're always remembering what their spouse did to them a day ago, a week ago, a year ago, with regard to our wives, 10 years ago, right? Men forget, but wives remember. And they're taking into account a wrong suffered. Love does not seek harm. It does not seek vengeance. It does not seek retaliation. It does not sit there and dwell on the past or dwell on crimes previously committed. That's what that means there about does not take into account a wrong suffered. Love bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. What a great summation here. It is the finest and most noble of all virtues. And whenever we talk about virtues, we're really talking about attributes of God. Anytime someone talks about someone or something that is virtuous, they're really saying it's like God. And love is the finest of all virtues. It seeks to forgive and it seeks to restore. It is optimistic and always offers the benefit of doubt. It is pure, it is timeless, it is transcendent. It does not impose on anyone and yet cannot be destroyed by anyone. It is the reason for life and mercy and grace and justice. That is what God's love is all about, which is really what God is all about. Because remember, that's really what we've said. That all these things deserve a lesson in themselves. But what we're getting at here is that when we cite these points here, we're not just looking at it bullet points of, you know, godly virtues. We're really taking a snapshot of God himself because he is all these things. God is patient. God is kind. God is not jealous, not in the way that jealous people are. God does not brag. He certainly is not arrogant, does not act unbecomingly, and so on. This is really what God is. But it also means, and this is Paul's point, that this is an ideal pursuit for every Christian as well. This is what real and godly love looks like. And if your love, Paul is saying to all of us, if your love does not look like that, then you have a different kind of love than you should be practicing as a child of God. And that doesn't mean that everything's wrong with it, but it does mean that it doesn't measure up yet, and it needs to. It needs to be worked on still. And so I'm asking you in this series, in this lesson especially, to examine yourself. Are you all those things? Are you patient? Are you kind? Are you not jealous? Are you not bragging? Are you not arrogant? So on. All those things that we just looked at, you really need to look at yourself for that. And I think in some cases you're going to do pretty well. And there might be others in which you falter. There are still others in which those things are just missing altogether, like, I never thought of that. Or, no, that's not me. That's not what I do. That's not who I am. But it needs to be who you are. I mean, if you want to spend time in eternity with this God who is love, then he expects you to modify and qualify the love that you express here with who he is. It's not enough, though, to identify the problem. Now you need to confront it, and now you need to do something about that. Paul is not saying here, if you decide to love, then here's some tips or suggestions, right, that can accompany that. He's saying we need to love. And then he says, and our love must strive to look like God's love. After all, God didn't learn how to love by watching all of us, right? I mean, what a mess we'd all be in if he did. We just don't love perfectly. We being people as in general is all I'm saying. We just don't. We don't love perfectly. We're typically selfish in our love. We're self-serving in our love. Even in our best, our finest hour, our love still is not always what it should be, even though we think it is, even though maybe others think it is. We love because he first loved us. We learn how to love from the one who loves best. And while we cannot duplicate it, as you see there, we certainly can strive to imitate it. So here's where the rubber meets the road, right here in this kind of lesson. You need to look at yourself and ask yourself, how do I love people? How do I love God? We've talked about that, but really, how do I love people? Because that will tell you a lot about how you love God. I want you to think about that. If you're married, for example, how is your love for your spouse? And a lot of people, especially after they've been married for 10 or 20 or, you know, 100 years, they typically are so used to their spouse and used to their spouse's ways, they've grown very comfortable. But that's not what we're asking here. We're not saying, is your love comfortable? Or we're not saying, is your love familiar? Like, we've got a familiar routine, and because we all know our place, and we, you know, I do my thing, and my wife does hers, or my husband does his, you know, that we all kind of have a shared relationship with each other. You know, you could be roommates and do that. So do you really love your spouse with that kind of love that we just examined? Is that the kind of love that you have? Don't confuse familiarity and longevity and convenience and comfort with godly love. are not necessarily the same thing. How do you love your family? Do you show them what is in their best interest? And I'm not saying you show them so that they'll show you. We don't love to get reciprocation. We love because it's the right thing to do. How do you love your family? What about your church family, your spiritual family? Because if you can't love your fellow Christian well or with a godly love, and you are wholly unprepared to take your love out to the world and show them what love looks like. How do you love your fellow Christians? How do you love your fellow members of this congregation if you're a member here? How do you love? Because if you're loving people with a very worldly or self-serving or selfish or very limited, purposely limited, finite love, and then sitting there talking about how you love God, I, for one, don't buy it. And God is certainly not going to buy it. He wouldn't buy it from me. He's not going to buy it from you. So this is where we need to really examine ourselves and say, what does my love look like? I want you to really look at your relationships with other people, the people in your life, especially those who are closest to you. Unfortunately, we tend to take advantage of and mistreat the people that are very close to us. And I've seen this in my own family. Now, I don't mean honey and the kids. I mean like my physical family. And we were just talking about this yesterday, that my physical family would treat total strangers better than they would treat us. Why is that? What do you do? Do you treat total strangers better than you do your own fellow Christians? Better than your spouse? Better than people that you claim to love and want to be with forever? Where's that going to get you? That's just not the right way to handle that. Loving God is not easy. I'll be the first to say. It is challenging. It is time-consuming. It's a complex issue. On the other hand, since we are all expected and capable of this love, it is within each Christian's ability to practice it and to improve it. And that's where the rest of the lesson goes, is to offer some suggestions, in essence, because this isn't God speaking so much as Chad speaking based upon what God has taught here. Here's some offerings that might help you. First of all, be serious and realistic about your love. This is not a game. You're going to be measured by God about how you love or maybe don't love, as it might be. You're going to be held accountable to this. So you should not take this lightly. You should put a lot of emphasis on this. Don't measure your love by someone else's love. Because what does that prove? Okay, you love better than me. What does that prove? It doesn't mean that either one of us are any closer to God than we should be. And likely another person's love will not be equal to yours anyway. Don't reduce your love to God or to your fellow man, if you will, because of your circumstances, because of your limitations, or because of your excuses or crutches. We're not looking for loopholes and escape clauses here. We're looking for what is it that I need to do and how can I do it the best? How can I do it rightly? So you need to ask yourself, what is God worth to you? What is he worth to you? In your professed love for God, is he worth everything to you? Or is that just what you say? Is that what you tell people? Is that what you tell yourself? But what does it show? How does it show in your life? What is Christ's sacrifice worth to you? And what are you worth to him? You know that Christ has gone to the ends of the earth, to the edge of the universe. He's gone to all that he could do to show his love for you. He's done everything possible. There's nothing more he could have done to show his love for you. When he went to that cross, he showed his love for you and for me in ways that we cannot even put into words, in ways we cannot even understand. But we know it's there and we know it's powerful. But then he asked you, if you wish to come after me, you have to deny yourself. Which isn't just about denying things. Sometimes we think that, like, okay, I can't smoke anymore, I can't drink anymore, I can't, you know, gamble anymore. It's not about that, really. It's about putting him first. I need to love him more than I love everything and anyone else. And is that what you're doing? How far are you willing to go to demonstrate your love for God? Are you putting limits on it? Like, I'll do this much, but I'm not going to do any more than this. And you got this measurement here. You know what Paul talks about when the fruit of the Spirit? There are no laws. There's no boundaries. Nothing. No limitations. You don't talk about how much you love or how little you love. You just talk about love in its fullest sense. Same with peace and patience and kindness and joy and all those things. We don't put measurements on those things as Christians. We don't sit there and quantify that, like, how much joy do you have? Or how much kindness did you show? And we have a little box, you know, that we've put this in. It's not like that. There are no boxes. There are no boundaries. There are no limitations. Do you have things or people in your life that you are unwilling to let go of in pursuit of your love for God? I can't answer this for you. But if there's anyone or anything in your life that is holding you back from loving God the way you're supposed to, that thing or person needs to go. And I don't mean you need to rip that person out of your life necessarily, but in your heart, they need to be brought down subordinate to God's love. And you're the one in charge of that. It's not their responsibility to do that. That's yours. Is your love for God unconditional? Because we spent a whole lesson talking about how God's love for you is unconditional. He loves you no matter what. He doesn't love you because you did this or if you did that or when you do these things. He loves you anyway. Is that how you love God? And is that how you love God's people? If your love is not what it should be or where it should be, then what's stopping you? Really, the question is, what are you allowing to stop that? Remember, we did a lesson here not long ago in January. What you allow will continue. And if you're allowing something to stop you from loving God unconditionally, then that will continue as long as you allow that. As long as it's there, because you're not removing it, it will always be there. It'll be there till the day you die. And then you'll have to face God, and one of the first questions he may ask you is, why didn't you take care of that? Why did you leave that thing there when I told you that that needed to go? Someone says, I want to love God more, but, and then fill in the blank with whatever's holding him back. What's your holdout? God has no holdouts. What is yours? These are tough questions, to be sure. But these are the questions that need to be asked. Let the light of God expose your love for what it really is. Don't be afraid or resistant to God's examination of your love. What he reveals to you may be very uncomfortable, may be very unsettling, may be very disturbing, but let him do his work. I guarantee that if you had some malignant tumor or cancer in you, you would probably allow the surgeon to go in there, even though it was very uncomfortable, very unsettling, and very inconvenient, and you would allow him to go in there with his knife and cut that thing out so you could survive. Well, let God do the same thing to your heart. Let him do that so that you can survive. John chapter 3, verse 20 and 21, Jesus says, everyone who does evil hates the light, does not come to the light for fear that his deeds will be exposed. I know we often think of evil heathens out there, unchristian, you know, pagans out there in the world, but it can refer to anyone, even those who call themselves Christians. If you're resisting the light, then you're saying you hate the light. And you're not allowing your deeds to be exposed by the light. But he who practices the truth, he goes on to say, comes to the light. Comes to the light. Doesn't go and get found by the light, but comes to the light so that his deeds may be manifested as having been wrought or made in God. Are you running from the light? Or are you coming to the light? It's a good question to ask. We must engage in Bible study and spiritual discussions and prayer for the purpose of self-exposure, because that's what enlightenment is all about. Not just a mere accumulation of facts and information and verses. In Romans 2:16, on the final day, Paul says that God will judge the secrets of men through Christ Jesus. For many Christians, sadly, the one secret that will be revealed there will be how little or how shallow or how incomplete their love for God was, something they could have addressed but just chose not to because there was always something else in the way. It could have been done, but it wasn't. Don't be one of those people. You can't afford to be one of those people. Stop trying to reform yourself from the outside in, because true spiritual reform, I am not the first one to say this, true spiritual reform always is from the inside out. The Sermon on the Mount, the whole theme of the Sermon on the Mount from Jesus' own mouth, Matthew 5, 6, and 7, is basically this: get your heart right with God, because the rest will follow. And what do? We say something like, well, if I stop doing this, insert some sinful behavior, then I will love God better. Or if I start doing this, then I'll be a better Christian or something like that. That is outside in thinking. That is backwards. What you really need to focus on, what I need to focus on, any Christian needs to focus on, is what's going on inside of me that is projecting itself outside of me. Because if you've got some chronic bad behavior, some chronic addiction, or just some things that you do over and over, and you keep saying, I don't know why I do that. I know why you're doing that. God knows why you're doing that. There's something wrong with your heart, and it needs to be fixed. If you learn to love God better, it will naturally produce godly and Christian behavior. As we said before, if you improve the quality of the tree, then it naturally produces better fruit. No one has ever been transformed by picking all the bad fruit off their tree. That never has helped anybody. It just stalls the process, honestly. Matthew 12:33, Jesus himself said, either make the tree good and its fruit good, or make the tree bad and its fruit bad. In other words, you're in charge of making it one way or the other, for the tree is known by its fruit. Jesus isn't talking about trees. He's not literally talking about apples and cherries here. He's talking about you. He's talking about me. He's talking about our heart and what we produce from that heart. Going to church and singing songs and praying prayers does not make a good tree. Loving God with all your heart, your soul, your mind, that makes a good tree. And guess what people do who do that? They go to church, they sing songs, and they do all those other things that we could say. But it's because their heart is right. It's not because they're trying to reform their outward behavior by doing things. Doing good works is never a replacement for a deeper love for God. Never does replace that. Merely abstaining from evil is not a solution to the problem. We misrepresent the gospel to ourselves and to others when we concentrate on behavior rather than the disposition of our heart, which all involves our love for God. Imagine if your car's not running right. I mean, it's maybe not running at all, and you decide to fix it, you're going to give it a nice paint job. That's how people think. Car's not running right. I think I need to go out and wash it. Give it a paint job. Scrub the tires. That'll fix it. I guarantee that car's not going to run any better once you're done with this sparkling new paint job. But think about it. This is what people do with their lives, right? Oh, there's something wrong in my heart. There's something wrong with my love. I know. I'll go to church more. I'll sing more songs. I'll give more. I'll do good deeds. That ought to take care of it. All you're doing is painting the car. The engine's still is kaput. Doesn't help a thing. But this is how we think, and it's backward thinking. Last lesson, I talked about a love-based belief system versus work-based. Love must be your why. There has to be a why you do what you do. There has to be a motive behind what you do. So imagine someone who is stealing, right? Like shoplifting or something like that. And he says to himself, you know what? If I stop stealing, then I'll love God better. It's like, no, if you love God better, you'd stop stealing. Right? Because every one of us know, anyone who's dealt with any kind of chronic or bad behavior knows that if you just stop one bad behavior, it will resurface somewhere else, manifest itself elsewhere in your life as a different bad behavior. I know I'm right. You don't even have to agree with me. I know I'm right. And I'm not right because I'm so smart. I'm right because millions and millions of people have done just this. And it's been observed a lot. But if you change the heart, now you're changing where that bad behavior comes from. And if you love God with all your heart, your soul, and your mind, it's not going to produce bad behavior ever. It changes everything. It's the ultimate game changer. Learn from the master. In Matthew chapter 11, verse 28 through 30, Jesus gives the greatest invitation that's ever been given. Come to me, all ye who are weary and heavy laden. I use ye because it's in our songs, okay? So, but he's saying, come to me, learn from me, take my yoke, let me have yours. Yours is too heavy, it'll kill you. Here, have mine, it's bearable, it's doable, it's light in comparison. Come to me and learn from me. Why? Well, because John 15:5, Jesus says there that apart from me, you can do nothing. You can't help yourself. I know we all want to think that we can. Well, if I study harder, and if I pray more, and if I go to more church services and sing louder, you know, then I'll be a better person. If you don't come to Christ, you will never be a better person. And if you don't love God with all your heart, soul, and might, you will never be a better person. Outwardly, perhaps, but not inwardly where it counts. And it's that inward thing that God's going to expose on that final day. That's where it's going to all count the most. You need to do your part. Jesus loves you, but that's not enough that Jesus loves you. You need to come to him, learn from him, and love him in return. Jesus does not say, come to church and learn from the preacher. While there might be some benefit to all of that, that's not what he's saying. He says, come to him on a level that you come to no one else. And love him like you love no one else, no matter how close they might be to you. Let him teach you how to do that. Because he does. He does teach you. And it will not be comfortable. Which is really grating at the problem here. Because we think that Jesus says, love me as you feel comfortable doing so. As long as you love me at all, I'm happy with that. That's what we think Jesus says. And that's not what he's saying. The world is obsessed with comfort and convenience right now. And sadly, so are so many Christians, obsessed with comfort and convenience. Discipleship is not about comfort, and it's inconvenient. It's about conformity to the master. You should have known that before you were baptized. You should have known what disciples were. They're students and pupils of the master. The best way to honor the Father is to love him like Jesus loved him. And if you and I strive for this, then we will not be disappointed in the results. Because we love more like Jesus, we will start looking more like Jesus. People will see this. It will be a good thing. No one's going to look at you down their nose, not anyone who understands the value of this, and go, oh, you're becoming more like Jesus. Psh. You know, your worldly friends might do that. It doesn't matter. But your Christians who know better, they will look at you with admiration and go, you're becoming more like Jesus. Because you're loving more like him all the time. And in the hereafter, then you will be where Jesus is, which is exactly what I think that you all want is why you're here this morning. As I said, practicing godly love, not just love like we choose, but godly love is taxing, it's time-consuming, it's difficult, it's sacrificial, it makes us vulnerable, and it demands a lot from us, it does. And yet, it is the most realistic, positive, and dynamic way to live. And people are always out there going, I want to live life to the fullest. And they're out there doing extreme sports and, you know, all kinds of weird things or trying drugs or getting drunk or, you know, having affairs. They want to live life to the fullest. You know, if you love God with all your heart, soul, and mind, you would live life to the fullest. You would live life like you were supposed to be in the first place. You would be more like Jesus, who lived life to the fullest in his love for his Father. That's what Paul was talking about when he talked about what love is, living life to the fullest. All other loves boil down to basically how to enjoy life on my own terms, or how to get others to meet my expectations, or how to have my cake and eat it too. And all those are just various forms of very selfish love. It's love, but it's very selfish. No one learned any of that from Jesus. We learn that from the world. Do you have gifts or talents, or good works that you're offering to God? I know that a lot of you do. I know that I do too. And we do so because we want to. And that's all very well. You are expected to do that. And quite frankly, the God of heaven deserves that. However, there is one gift that God wants up front and more than all others, and that is your love, really your heart, your love for him. He wants that gift up front. This is the more excellent way than trying to earn your way to heaven with good deeds and scorekeeping, which is usually how we do things. We keep score. We may not write it down, but we got it in our head, like, well, now I can't be a bad person because I go to church and I do all these things and I read my Bible. I can't be a bad person. Actually, it doesn't mean you're a good person. But if you love God with all your heart, soul, and mind, you will be a good person. Not on your own merit, but because you will know then what it means to have fellowship with God. The more excellent way then should not be brushed aside or made expendable. Instead, it ought to be made a priority. Take care of first things first, and then everything else falls into place exactly where and how it needs to be. Trust God that he will take care of you. This lesson does end this series, but I do challenge you to examine your love and see how and where and why it may need improving. I say may, kind of tongue-in-cheek, because in my strong opinion, everyone's love needs improving, including my own, which is why this series has affected me so much. I didn't realize how really off-centered some of my love was for the Lord, for people. As your love for God and the Son of God improves, you improve overall. Because, and let me leave you with this, if you heal the tree, and good fruit will follow. Heal the tree, good fruit will follow. That's our lesson this morning. That's our series for you. If there's anyone here this morning that needs to respond by coming forward, this will be your time as we stand and sing the song has been selected for us.